Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? How's it going? How are you? Yeah. How's it going with you? Did you get that thing fixed? It'll grow out. It'll grow out, you know? I mean, it's been a long time since you've had a nice haircut. You know, you forget that sometimes it takes time. Hey, it's okay if people think you're talking too loud. It's just a natural transition period. We're all excited to not be crying. We're excited to not have to be in the house all the time with the people we love, barely. It's still a transition time. Nothing is normal. There is no collective culture. Everything is fragmented. Nobody knows what the other person knows because we're drawing from different perceptions of reality, different lenses, different portals. They're mining our minds, and we are locking in to the one that suits that best. Has nothing to do with reality. So nobody's on the same page, but I hope you're well. Are you? How's the finger? How's the toe? How's the leg? How's the ankle? How's the neck? How's the ears? The ears okay? I'm telling you, your hair looks fine, all right? I'm sorry you had to put the cat down. I'm sorry you had to put the dog down. I'm sorry the fish died. The kid's got to learn sometime, right? I mean, that's what fish are for, not my idea. How's it going, folks? Look, a couple of things on the mind. First of all, John Swab is here. John Swab is a director who directed the film Body Brokers, which I liked a lot. That's the reason I talked to Melissa Leo a while back. I also wanted to talk about it with Michael K. Williams. I mean, it's about drugs. It's about recovery. It's about the dark side of the recovery racket, the business, the rehab, the business, moving money through the sickness of others. Something that happens a lot. I would argue that almost all of American capitalism is built on that one way or the other. But this was specifically about the rackets that grew out of the money being given through Obamacare to rehab centers and rehab clinics and drug treatment related medical procedures. I thought it was a great subject, a great movie, very compelling, dark. But I talked to John. I wanted to talk to Swab about it. I watched his other movies. Well, one of them. I couldn't find the other one. But I'll get back to that in a minute. I would like to tell people that do not know that Sword of Trust, this is the last film from Lynn Shelton, my late girlfriend. It stars me and Michaela Watkins and John Bass and Jillian Bell, Toby Huss, Dan Backdahl. It's a great film, and it's now on Netflix. Sword of Trust can be watched on Netflix now. So if you'd like to enjoy that movie, if you've heard about it or you're curious about it, you can watch it. Also, the tour, my tour, it's not really a tour. I'll be doing some club dates in the near future, August 5th, 6th, 7th. I will be at the Comedy Works in Denver. I will be at Stand Up Live in Phoenix, one night only, August 12th. I will be at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City, August 19th, 20th, and 21st. I will be at Helium in St. Louis, September 16th, 17th, and 18th. That's what I've got on the docket currently. I know I'm going to be up in Bloomington at some point. I don't know. Are those dates not up for sale? I don't know what's happening. Are they sold out? I'll look. I'll check. But if you'd like to see me, the Dynasty shows for the next three Thursdays are sold out. And I don't know if I talked to you guys about it, about entering. I definitely didn't talk to you about it. I okay, so you know the process. I'm losing my mind. You know, I'm trying to put together an hour. I don't know how much I've got. I know I've probably got about 20, 30 minutes probably, and a lot of things that I'm curious about and talking about and want to talk about. But this is the next, this was the giant step forward. The big leap forward was to move from the workout room, the Comedy Store, doing 15 to 20 every night, punching it out. Getting into the right groove, the right tone, developing that relationship with the audience. Then last Thursday was the first night I was going to do the hour-long set, riff through it at Dynasty Typewriter. Haven't done that much time in a long time. Granted, I've been doing some Instagram lives, whatever. You know, I get kind of hyper and weird and insecure about certain things and concerned, you know, and I was just ready to really kind of be with my audience so I could sort of open my heart and move through some of the ideas I'm thinking about and some of the funny stuff I'm thinking about. So I'm ready to go. You know, I've made some notes. I've got the right mindset. And I'm like, this will be great. This will be my people. It'll be a small room, couple hundred friendlies. And we'll fucking do it. So I don't want anyone to really go with me, except for Jerry Stahl. He's a guy that I trust my insecurities and my darkness with. So I figure he'd get off on it, and I trust his opinion about what goes down. So Jerry's going to go with me. He comes over. We head out from my house down to Dynasty, and I noticed, you know, we're going down fucking Glendale Boulevard. Where the fuck do you get off? Yeah, all the way downtown. And we're about, you know, 5-10 minutes out, and my tire is going flat. I can see it on my dashboard with the little thing. Air is going out of the tire quickly. And so we pull up to Dynasty. They have a driveway in the back with a gate on it. And at that point, there's no air in one of my tires. So I'm fucked. I've got a flat. So that's, you know, I'm heading into the hour, trying to get in the right mind, and I get a flat. So we pull up to the gate, and right as another car had just pulled into a space that wasn't a space right next to where I got to pull in. Big car, luxury car. I want to say a Cadillac. I'm not sure. Maybe it was a... It was a big car. And I'm like, what the fuck's this guy doing? What is he doing? And, you know, he wasn't even a space. I had to kind of pull around him to get in the driveway and then walk out to the front of Dynasty to get someone to come open the gate. And I got a flat tire on the back tire, and it's 7:30, showtime's at 8. And I'm like, what's up with this dude in this car? It's just a big dude just sitting in the car. I'm like, is there going to be fucking trouble? And, you know, I get out of the car to sort of deal with the gate. And then this guy gets out of his car. He's a big dude, like classic, you know, East Coast looking big dude, older dude, like Italian, like old school looking big dude, like an Italian looking guy. And I'm looking at him thinking, like, what are we doing? You know, he's smoking a cigarette. And I'm like, what is happening here? And he goes, oh, my, you're him. Mark Maron, it's Mark Maron. You're Mark Maron. Oh, my wife loves you. She's online right now. Hold on a minute. He's calling his wife. Hey, baby, Mark Maron's right here in front of me. Mark Maron, come over and meet him. You want to meet my wife, right? I thought you were an asshole, but she loves you. You're not. You're all right. Mark Maron is here. I'm like, oh my God, how is this happening? How is this guy going to be in the room of love? How is this the guy? Why is this the first thing? I got a flat tire, and I got this guy here, and he's calling his wife. He's like, what, you want me to call AAA? I got gold. I got AAA gold. I'm like, take it easy, man. I'm going to deal with the tire. I'll call him. It's no problem. Here comes my wife. Mark Maron, you want to picture? I'm like, holy shit, it's a scene in front of the theater in Annie Hall. I'm here with two guys. I'm with the cast of The Godfather. I'm standing here talking to two guys named Cheech. It was one guy named Cheech, but his name wasn't named Cheech. I forget his name now, but he was very excited for his wife. So his wife comes. I say hi, but I got to deal with the tire. And Jerry is at this point, like, when I come back to see if the guy's going to open the gate, he's already trying to sort of edge away from the situation and walk towards the theater. I'm like, where are you going? And the guy's like, I called AAA. I'm like, hang up. Don't call AAA. I'm going to take care of this. Hang up the phone. And his wife goes, come on, honey, hang up the phone. Let him deal with it. Don't make a big deal. I'm like, please, please go in the theater. Relax, you know, just let me deal with this. And he's like, you sure, Mark, I can take care of it? You know, I build buildings. I'm building a high rise down on Pico. I'm the contract. I'm like, all right. I gotta get ready. And his wife's like, come on, he needs to get ready. I'm like, oh my God, what the fuck is happening? I got a flat tire. They open the gate, and, you know, and I'm like, do I call AAA? I don't want to fucking wait for AAA. I don't want someone out here waiting for AAA. I gotta deal with this, man. So I just fucking empty my trunk and I get the jack. I got a spare in there. I fucking pull the tire off. I put the fucking spare on. It's now 7:40. The big guy has gone into the theater. I go into the theater. I'm sweaty. I'm dirty from changing a tire. I don't know what the fuck is happening. But all I know in my head is that, like, look, man, I don't believe in God shots. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in a mystical order to things, although occasionally I'll be sitting upstairs in the room upstairs looking out the window and a hummingbird will just hover and look right at me, right inside. I don't know who that is. I don't know if the bird is like, look, man, you all right? Where's the fucking, why don't you fill up the feeder? Who are you? I don't know if that's my dead girlfriend sending a message. I don't know why that my biggest concern is like, look, man, I don't want to perform for meatheads. I don't want to fucking, you know, have to worry about that. I just want to open up and do my thing. And this guy shows up and I get up there and I'm like, I got to do the job now. All I'm worrying about is I don't want that guy to fucking start talking in the middle like, here we go. This is a, what are we doing? But this guy loves his wife. His wife is, you know, is my fan. But all I'm worried about is, like, I don't want this guy making a scene. So I get up on stage and I tell the whole story of what I'm telling you right now. I guess it was a territorial thing. Like, I am like a professional. Don't fuck with me. This is my space. This is what I know is happening. So you got something you want to get out? Let's do it now. I just gave you 5 minutes of my time. I told the story, got some good laughs. I know you're in here. Are we good? Nothing. Great. I've established my territory. Now let's do the show. And it made me lean in, man. It made me fucking step up. It made me do the job. I'm like, you know what? I'm an entertainer. I've prided myself on being a club comic in a lot of ways. I can make anybody laugh. What am I worried about this guy? And I did an hour and 25 minutes, and it was a lot of great stuff. It definitely a nice foundation for the work I need to do. And it gave me, made me realize that, you know, I'm ready. You know, I'll go do those clubs and I'll have enough to talk about. I don't know why I didn't believe that. I go on Instagram Live and do it an hour and a half, wandering around my house with my goddamn cats, Buster and Sammy Red, Shmooly and Booster. But then after the show, I go outside and this guy's in this non-parking space. He's standing there as I walk out. He's got two flat tires. Someone flattened both his tires because he was parked wrong. He's like, if you want to come see the high rise, I'm like, I get it. I'm good. He's like, hey, what are you doing? Did you call AAA? She's calling him. Can you believe it? Two flat tires. And I'm like, I can't, man. Hey, it's nice meeting you. And I got out of there. It was quite a night. But it felt good. I don't know if anyone cares. I don't know if it's relevant. I need it to be relevant to me. And it felt that way. It felt like there's things to do. There's places to go. The world that is my world, the world of people that give a shit about my world will enjoy what I have to say. I can't speak for all the other worlds. So many worlds, people. So many fucking worlds. Right? So Danny Trejo on Monday and John Schwab today. John Schwab also in recovery. Got a bit of time. And it turns out these movies he made, both of the Running with the Hunted, is that what it's called? Run with the Hunted, I think, and Body Brokers come from, you know, his direct experience. And it's pretty devastating and pretty dark. And this is a dark tale, but he is sober and he does seem grounded. And, you know, it's a hell of a story, Oklahoma story. But I was thrilled to talk to him. This is a heavy recovery week. Big recovery week here on WTF. Some dark tales that end up okay, man. There is hope. There is hope. You can get off it. You can stop it. I just talked to a person I kind of know, but I kind of grew up with. They have a drinking problem. I mean, it's something so common. There needs to be an open dialogue around it. But you can recover. You can change, as my two guests this week speak to. Body Brokers is now available to buy or rent on digital and on-demand platforms, or you can watch it on Cinemax starting tomorrow, July 9th. He's got a new film as well coming out with most of the same cast, Melissa Leo and the crew. Ida Red begins playing on the festival circuit in August and will be coming to theaters later this year. I didn't know what to expect, and I was glad I talked to this guy because I think that the work he did was important. It certainly shined a light on something and certainly humanized a very dark, the dark world of addiction, but also the the very dark world of recovery scamming. So this is me talking to John Swab.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
What are you doing here? Just come in for a thing?
Dude, I came in, you know, I've been listening to this show a long time.
Oh, really?
Dude, I mean, 9 years.
Wow.
So.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, of course. So when he told me, I was like, well, I'm going to the garage, man. You know, I'm not going to do, you know, because all the interviews I've done for this movie have been, you know, virtually. So I was.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about the movie. I've been thinking about Tulsa. I watched the other, one of the other movies, the one that was easier to find, Run with the Hunted, I watched. And I couldn't find the other one. The other one seems to be harder to find.
The other one, I think, has been, it's been pulled from the internet.
Because of Marilyn Manson or what?
I'm not certain, but around the same time. That happened. It
really?
Yeah, yeah.
It's called Let Me Make You a Martyr.
Let Me Make You
they
a Martyr.
They just pull it. They don't alert you. Like, you know, you're part of this. And
the company that we did that deal with, I have some issues with. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
Huh.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so where do you live now?
I live in Woodstock, New York right now.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long have you been up there?
I've been there about 6 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you buy a farm?
No. I wish I could afford
You're not living in an apartment, are you?
No, I live on a, you know, in a nice house on a piece of land, and I actually just, but I bought a house in Tulsa where I'm from this
going
week.
Going back,
I do a lot of work there, you know, a lot of movies and
I don't have any sense. Like, I grew up in New Mexico, driven through Oklahoma.
Right.
I've only talked to a couple people who are actually from Oklahoma. I talked to Wayne from Oklahoma City, Coyne.
Sure.
And then I talked to Tim Blake Nelson.
Oh, yeah, love that guy.
Yeah, yeah, one of the great Oklahoma Jews.
Yep.
One of the five. And
one of the five. I know the other four. Yeah.
And, you know, I know there's a rough history to it, but you grew up your whole life in Tulsa.
Until I was 18, yeah, yeah.
Like, what is that? What did your, like, what was your family there for generations?
You know, I was just getting the history from my grandmother about all this.
Really?
Yeah. So they were in Missouri before that.
Right.
And
People wanted to leave Missouri even then.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's still rough.
Yeah.
And they moved to Indian Territory.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't know why.
Really?
Yeah.
Her grandparents?
Her grandparents. Yeah. And she was giving me 2 days ago, I saw her and she was telling me all this. It was really interesting.
Yeah.
So she's been there ever since.
Wow. The Indian Territory part sounds interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I guess we're native or portion thereof, but by whoever, I guess it was my great grandmother,
yeah,
didn't sign the scrolls for fear of being, you know.
What do you mean the scrolls?
Like, so what, apparently, I'm gonna botch this, but, you know, if you signed the scrolls, we'll call them,
yeah.
You know, you basically are on record as having, you know,
Native American person.
Yep. And
right.
You can get free health care and all these kinds
and
of things.
Casino money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Free health care and the casino money.
Exactly. Yeah.
The new perk.
Yeah. The American dream. Yeah.
But so you don't know. You got no proof is what you're saying.
I don't have any proof.
You're not going to be able to produce your movie with any of that weird casino money.
No.
But if you did know, what tribe do you think it would be?
A Creek is what I've been told.
I can't imagine, like, just talking about it now, the expanse of all those people and where they ended up is horrifying. And you can feel the weight of it, though, there, can't you?
It's heavy. It's
yeah.
Very, yeah.
Like in Tulsa, I imagine just the, you know, on the streets.
Yeah. I mean, Tulsa's an interesting place. And I've grown to realize that, you know, the longer I was away from it and now the more I'm there and older, there's a lot of history there.
Right.
You know,
what draws you to it still, other than like, hey, there's that store I used to go to?
Just work. You
yeah.
know? I mean, I've made, I guess, five movies there now. And
so you got two in the can that aren't out?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And we just wrapped one in Montana, actually, that was not shot in Oklahoma. But
that one's called Ida Red?
No, that one's coming out this fall.
Yeah.
We just shot a movie called Candyland, which is about lot lizards, a horror movie. And that comes out, I don't know when.
I was hoping it was about the board game.
It's, you know.
So you got Melissa Leo in the new one, too, again, huh?
In Ida Red, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I love that woman.
Well, yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah.
What's that movie about?
That movie is about, it's kind of like, you know, once after we got done with Body Brokers, I needed to kind of take a break from the social responsibility of a movie like that.
Yeah.
Where and you know, I love 70s, you know, crime cinema,
yeah.
And which is kind of an homage to, you know, Straight Time or, you know,
oh, yeah, yeah.
The Getaway or
really?
I love Peckinpah.
Peckinpah. All day long, man.
Yeah.
I used to do a yearly Peckinpah Film Festival.
Really?
Yeah, but I'd go all the way back to, like, Ride the High Country and
wow.
go all the way through. Just watch them. I love them. I love the, I can watch Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
That's my favorite.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean.
Where he's just talking.
Warren Oates, talking to the
talking
head.
Talking to the head.
Oh, man, like, yeah. Yeah.
Just flies buzzing
yeah.
around.
Yeah.
Yeah, that movie's crazy.
Yeah.
And I watched, what do I like? I think my least favorite one, I hadn't watched The Killer Elite in a long time. And like maybe since I saw it with my dad or like when I was a kid.
Sure.
I watched that again. It's much better than I remember.
Right.
And I don't watch Convoy. Although they shot that in Albuquerque when I was a kid. And I went down to the Hilton Hotel to see if I'd get autographs from the people in Convoy. Because it was one of those weird... Everyone was in it movies.
Sure.
And I ended up meeting Ernest Borgnine. That was a big day.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. My favorite's Getaway.
Yeah, it's great.
Great. Steve McQueen, I can't get enough of that
guy. I talked to Sally Struthers about it.
Wow.
Did you listen to that one?
No.
Because that's the one she's in, right? She plays the veterinarian's wife. And we talked about that dude, that guy who was in The Godfather.
Yes, yes.
What's his name? I wish I could remember his
name. I can't remember his name, but I can't forget his face. Yeah.
Well, she, you know, she talked about that scene with him. And that that was a great character. He played the Turk in Sollozzo in The Godfather.
Right, right.
Those guys that were around, those players.
Yeah.
You seem to be trying to build a little crew.
You know, I like working with people I like, you know. And it's fun to make movies, especially the size of movies we've been making. You know, it's much easier if the people... You know, our friends of yours, you know.
Sure, yeah. So, like, in Tulsa, you got brothers and sisters?
I have a little brother and a little sister, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're the oldest one?
I am.
And your folks are still around?
They are.
And what do they do?
My father is a criminal defense attorney now.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So,
what do you mean now? Like, it's a new thing?
He used to be on the other side. You know, when I was a kid, he was part of, like, the...
Prosecutor
for the state.
Paying his dues?
Yeah, paying his dues.
And then they just flip over and try to get people off?
Yeah, well, you know, you have enough kids and you need to, you know, make money, I guess. Yeah.
No, of course, Oh, that's interesting. And what's your mom do?
She's an artist, you know.
Like what? Painting?
All sorts of stuff, you know. Video stuff. When I was a kid, it was, you know, she was... doing photography, doing painting.
My mom was like that too.
Yeah.
So like that, so there is I guess I have to, and I think most of us have to not make assumptions about Tulsa. You're telling me that, like, I'm getting the sense that there's some, you know, kind of sophisticated, intelligent, creative people in Tulsa.
Yeah, there is. There is. Yeah. And, you know,
there's a community.
There's a community. And I guess that's changed a lot since I was a kid. But yeah, it seems to be kind of building a bit of a community. Yeah.
Is it like, do you feel that people are like coming back? Do you feel like that it's on the verge of some sort of a resurgence?
I don't know about a resurgence.
Is Tulsa going to be the new Austin?
You know, I think they'd like to, that's their pitch.
Yeah.
But I know that, you know, since the pandemic specifically, I mean, tons of people from, you know, California and, you know, they're moving, I think Texas, California... or Texas, New Mexico, and Montana have seen, like, you know, crazy amounts of people just moving in from the East and West Coast.
Yeah, I missed my shot. I grew up in New Mexico. And
right.
I was kind of holding on to this idea, like, I'm going to buy a house in New Mexico, but I could never really follow through with it because, like, what am I going to do there?
Right.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I want to live there.
Right.
It'd be nice to have a house there, but then how much time am I going to spend in there? And, like, when I go back, I'm like, okay, so I'm home. And what am I going to do here?
Right.
But you're going to be sitting around writing scripts and putting together.
Yeah, my wife loves it there.
Your wife is in the movie.
She's in Body Brokers. She's in a lot of my movies. Yeah.
But she's in Body Brokers? I'm trying to remember. What'd she play?
She plays the girl in the treatment center with Melissa Leo. She's crying and telling you about her daughter.
Oh, yeah.
So
But she's got that great part in Run with the Hunted.
Yeah, she's
as
great.
As the woman that the guy saved
when
he was a kid.
And she's in Let Me Make You a Martyr.
Yeah.
She's in Candyland. She's in a great band called the Bobby Lees. That's what she does. Yeah.
You guys got kids?
No kids.
Is that going to happen?
I don't know what we're going to do.
Sorry. I don't want pressure you or anything. But let's talk about Tulsa in terms of because I'm glad I watched the Run with the Hunted because, it was one of those movies where I don't know if it was intentional or not. I don't know what is intentional on behalf of directors, but I realized this morning that you're kind of playing, because I couldn't quite understand the kind of Oliver Twist nature of the thing, in terms of, the setup, there's a Fagin and there's all that. But then it wasn't really that. And then I realized because of the reference in the movie that you're kind of playing the neutered S.E. Hinton sense of childhood against the realities of what that childhood becomes.
Sure.
Is that on purpose?
I guess so. And that was beautifully put,
Because he's reading S.E. Hinton, and it's clear that, when you get into the grit of what those kind of lives become, kids who are on the streets for so long,
right.
And then, his little crew, they all seem so innocent, even
right.
though they were supposed to be criminals. And I don't know if it was just a matter of, who you could cast or who you found where you shot it or what it was, but it definitely felt like those kids came out of, the outsiders.
Right.
And Michael Pitt's character was, a hardened fucking monster in
right,
a way.
Right.
So and he was reading S.E. Hinton.
Right.
So it was sort of, I realized, because when I'm watching, I'm like, you could be a kid and watch this with your parents if you wanted to.
Right.
Though it doesn't end well. You're not a Hollywood ending guy, that's for sure.
Right.
It's more of a poetic ending.
I guess, yeah.
Poetic justice ending.
Yeah. That was my first movie I made sober. I came out of, the depths of everything and wanted to do so much in one movie. And, I think there's a lot of things I was trying in that movie and some worked out better than others. And I'm really proud of it, but it's definitely a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think that whether that was intentional or not, it was sort of interesting to me
right.
that there were these two worlds. And I didn't really realize it till this morning. Cause when I was watching it, there was part of me that was is he trying to sort of get kids to watch it? There was a tone to those kids where it almost felt, kind of designed to help kids.
Sure. I was really at the time fascinated with the idea of, I really wanted to make a kids movie.
Yeah.
Because I grew up Outsiders and Rumblefish were filmed where I was from. So
holy
I had
shit,
I,
Rumblefish.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, yeah. that's that. I prefer that to the Outsiders,
yeah.
But I had this weird attachment to these movies and I wanted to tell half a kid's story and then, where do you think it's going? And then take it the exact opposite direction and
right,
turn it into this other thing. Yeah. I think your analysis of it was great. Yeah, critique was great. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because what becomes different is that, there's usually some sort of lesson, in those movies and some people go down, but not that hard, right?
Right.
But in your version, it's here are these kids and in the scene in the truck and just the whole play of what is Ron Perlman? I mean, I'm generally speaking, what, I mean, I've talked to him. He's a lovely guy.
He's hysterical.
And he's a great actor. He has a hell of a presence. But that character was there's moments where you're is this guy really fucking evil?
Yeah.
But I thought the script was great in that, it didn't let on a lot of stuff. It kept it mysterious. You didn't know how dirty people were.
Right.
So I liked that. And then I started to wonder, Tulsa, how much of an influence was Larry Clark on you coming?
Huge.
That was the hero? That was the guy, right? That's the Tulsa guy.
There's a few Tulsa guys, but he's kind of the, I guess the black sheep of the Tulsa guys, literally, I think,
Well, just the book of photographs.
Yeah.
I mean, because I was thinking about that. I was wondering, because Michael Pitt was in Bully.
Yep.
And like, and then I don't know what happened to that guy. You know, he sort of disappeared. It was good to see him. I didn't even fucking recognize him when I was watching him in your movie.
Yeah.
Because he's a good actor.
And he's an unbelievable actor. Really.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah.
And also, you know, who I like is the guy who played the dirty dad in that movie.
Brad. Yeah.
Brad Carter.
Yeah. Brad Carter. Yeah.
Like, I've seen him and stuff where you're like, oh, fuck, that guy.
He steals
business.
Any scene he's in. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But it did remind me that there is a, you know, that you're kind of tapped into a lineage there. So, you know, because you go back to Kids with the Larry, you know, which is Larry Clark's other movie. He's made a few. But really, the book Tulsa is a menacing kind of impressionable book.
It's I remember when I first saw it, I was a kid.
Right.
And
you're like, wow, it's about my city.
Yeah, right. You know, but it changed me. I remember, you know, there's movies like that I saw that changed me. And just realizing, you know, I knew what a camera was, but I didn't know it could do that. You know, it could go in those places. Larry's book is, you know.
There's a couple of them, right? There's Tulsa, and then there's the ones he shot in Times Square, which are
and
then disturbing.
The teenagers.
Teenage Lust.
Yeah, there's a few others, but I think...
Yeah, Tulsa was good. Those pictures of that idiot who shot himself, you know, like in the leg.
Right.
You're like, what the fuck are these guys? They're just sitting around shooting speed.
Right, yeah.
Boy, hanging out with guns.
Yeah, well...
And I was like, that's Oklahoma in my head.
Yeah, it's... it kind of is in a lot of places, you know? And I'm proud of it, you know, in a weird way. But because I'm you know, that guy and, you know, at a cellular level. But I think... You know, people don't realize how big of an influence Larry was on pop culture or, you know, cinema at large. You know, just with those photos. I mean, you know, Scorsese, you know, references them. Paul Schrader does. I mean, a lot of people
that makes sense.
You know.
Paul Schrader.
Yeah. I love Paul Schrader too, man.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? I do too. Like, you know, these are dark men with problems.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
You know, I have that in me.
Right.
I have the feeling you went further out than I did.
Right.
Well, what was your trip? How did you get all fucked up? When did that start?
You know, same thing you probably have heard a bunch, you know, where I just...
13, 14?
Well, came out, you know, just feeling a little off and, you know, just slowly, you know, mixed up along the way, you know.
Got into the life.
Yeah.
But your parents seem like they were okay people.
They are good people. You know, I just think, you know, when I was growing up there, it was a very kind of walled off place, you know.
Tulsa.
Small community, very religious. And
did you grow up with the Christian stuff?
Oh, yeah.
So your folks are that way?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess there's a lot of Jesus in Oklahoma.
What
brand?
Jesus, guns, beef, teen pregnancy. We do those things well.
Oh, yeah?
That's
good,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, so,
is that on the sort of the states kind of like, when you like, what about Oklahoma? Teen pregnancy, meat, and Jesus. Come on.
Come on down.
Most of you are welcome. Yeah. We'll let you know if you're not.
Yeah.
So how religious?
I
mean, when you were brought up
I went to some Catholic school for a little while.
Oh, so it's Catholic, not Baptist?
No. You know, and you know, it's pretty just religious place, you know. Now I am not I'm more, I guess you'd call spiritual or whatever.
Sure, you know so that means how long you've been sober?
Coming up on 6 years.
Oh, pretty fresh still.
Yeah
Jeez.
Yeah.
So how bad'd you get?
Pretty bad. Yeah. It was pretty rough. Yeah.
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 Like a lot of different things, mostly booze, or did you get like out of your mind?
No, it was mostly
speed.
Junk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tough one. Good for you.
Yeah, junk, speed, crack.
Oh, crack.
Yeah, crack.
Oh.
Crack really.
That's good, man.
When I met that, you know, it was beautiful. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just sitting around with that pipe.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Waiting 15 minutes.
Yep. And
going again.
Going again.
Hell of a life. What'd you do today? That.
Yep.
All the way into the night.
Yep.
And then you come down with the dope.
Yep.
Oh, you had a system.
Yep. Yep, landing gear. Yep.
Landing gear, you called it.
Yeah.
That was the gift and the curse of my cocaine days, is I didn't have a connection for landing gear.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really a dope guy. So, like, you know, it was just me sitting around, you know, with my heart pounding, you know, jerking off for 9 hours to see if I could come down. But the lack of landing gear, I think, is what got me sober more quick. You lose your mind quicker without, landing gear.
Yeah, the landing gear kept me out there, you know, quite a long time, yeah.
Well, you look pretty healthy.
You know, I've made some changes recently, you know, diet changes.
Oh, really?
And like, yeah, you know.
So you were eating shit for 5 years?
I was eating a pound of bacon for the first year of sobriety, you know, every day.
A pound?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not that much.
Yeah.
But it's
good. Wouldn't think, but it adds up, you know?
Yeah. But that's one of those things where you first get in sober, people are like, hey, man, as long as you're not drinking.
Exactly.
Do whatever you want.
Right.
And you're
right.
Like, well, what can I do with that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a million things I could do. There's bacon, porn, gambling. This is great.
All of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Bacon. I hadn't thought of that. What'd you get your numbers? How's your blood numbers?
You know, I went and did my blood, I guess it was a year ago, and they pulled it out and they were like, this is like motor oil. You need to change up everything.
Like, stop the bacon.
You know? So I've started exercising and all that, and I feel much better. Yeah.
Well, so. God, you got through that 5 years, man. And that's hard. That's hard. Like, I know, you know, dope guys, like, a lot of times they can't quite do it. So they end up just figuring out a way to you know, kind of chip along, not with dope, but I mean, a little booze, a little weed, whatever.
Yeah, I tried all that, you know.
Can't do it.
It just doesn't work for me. Yeah.
Yeah, because you want to go back to the other.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, what am I doing here? Yeah.
So you were driven by, it sounds like in the same way that I am, like that your heroes were these dark characters that somehow, you know, managed to survive. I was thinking about that today, you know, about these, there's certain guys that just don't die, you know. And then there are guys that do die. But anytime if your hero, especially if your hero is a, you know, some sort of outlaw or some guy who's living out there on the fringe creatively, and they don't die, I don't think it's good for us. I think it's like sometimes because I was thinking about, like, you know, even like Bowie, you know, I can't remember the last time I bought a Bowie record, but when he dies, you're like, oh man.
Got to buy everything. Yeah.
Well, or just that, like, I can't believe he died. What do you mean? He wasn't that young. He was sick or whatever, but there's something about those guys dying that implies our own mortality.
Right.
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 Because we don't know it.
Right.
But we kind of expect those guys to live forever.
Sure.
Right. So it's just sort of wild that the drug heroes, a lot of them are still fucking kicking.
Yeah.
What did you think of Schrader's last movie? What was it? The Priest one.
The Priest one. I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, people really loved it.
Yeah.
I didn't love it like they loved it.
Yeah.
I'm more partial to, like, hardcore.
Oh,
you know, and like the old.
I just watched that again recently.
Oh man,
it's crazy.
Yeah,
right?
I'm a huge Peter Boyle fan too. So
when
he shows up in the diner and then the guy, you know, when he's in the theater watching the video, I mean, it's a great
George C. Scott.
Yeah, it's a great,
with like his hand over one eye.
Yeah, I mean. It's
and then when he plays the director,
and
puts on that mustache.
Oh man, it's awesome. Yeah,
like that was going to end well though. That's one of those movies where it's like, is that a good ending?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think that's what was so nice about movies back then is that they just ended like that.
Oh yeah.
You know, and now
you're like, what?
Yeah. You know, and nowadays, I mean, it's a problem if you end a movie like that. You know, I can tell you firsthand, like people don't. They don't want that, you know? I mean, there's all this Marvel shit out there, and everybody wants everything.
Sure, but even the smaller movies, you know, are, like, it takes a certain amount of fortitude, I guess, or courage to put them out there. It's easier to put them out there, but I guess the mainstream audience, I guess what we're learning is, there's a lot of people that just want to feel better or want to avoid life.
Right, right.
So they really cannot understand why you would put a movie out.
Exactly.
That makes them feel worse.
Right. Which are my favorite kind of movies.
Exactly.
You know, like.
Well, they're honest. There's an honesty to them. Like, I mean, come on, man. Like, the end of Run with the Hunted is sort of like a poetic thing.
You know, that movie, I learned more making that movie than any other movie I've made. And one of the reasons is because when Michael came, we had shot 10 days.
Yeah.
And we didn't have that character to play, you know, play the older version, Michael's character.
Okay.
So Michael finally agreed and he came to town and he wanted, you know, we ended up rewriting the script for like 2 days together. And so a lot of that portion of the movie was, I wouldn't say improvised, but more instinctively made on the day. So, you know, I wasn't as precious about the script there as I was with other films. So I don't think it was something that I really set out to do months before. In these, the movies, I'm realizing more about myself each one I make, but you know, with Body Brokers 2, they're kind of all about a cycle, you know, and you know, she's driving off into the night, he's there, and now she's kind of, you know, assumed responsibility for these boys. And you know, how he assumed responsibility for her when
oh, I see. So that was the idea.
Yeah.
I don't know if I put that together. Like, I mean, I guess we should tell people what it's about. It's about this, these two kids who were like 13 years old, and they were neighbors, and the boy had a sort of stable family, and this girl, not so stable to the degree where, you know, her father was this drunken, incestuous pig. So then, you know, the 13-year-old boy, you know, saves her, well, kills the old man, and then splits and grows up on the streets under the tutelage of some modern-day Fagans.
Pretty much, yeah. There you go.
And then she goes to find him.
Right.
Like, he's reported missing and stays missing and lives a life of crime. And she goes to find him and then does find him. That's the story. So the idea is that she's got to take care of those four kids?
I guess so, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. I don't know that, like, after it was done that I registered that. You know, like, yeah, I guess what does happen to him? There was part of me that sort of, like, I thought he was just going to say, like, okay, you guys can run free now.
He says something similar to that, I think. Yeah.
But is that, like, was that shot in Tulsa?
Yes.
So is it really that sparse? Because there are definitely long, big shots of open road there that didn't look like you had to close down the roads.
It's amazing. You go out at, like, you know, 10, 11 at night, and there's nobody on the streets, you know? It's there's something really nice about that, that I find, you know, I love to go out and walk in the night. And
nice or scary.
Well,
Yeah,
both.
Now, these guys, like, because I was talking to my producer, I was telling him, it's like, so when you reach out to them, because I've been reached out to about movies.
Sure.
So usually it's sort of like, how long do I got to shoot?
Sure.
How many days?
Right.
And that sometimes, if the script is good, because I know Melissa loves your writing, and the writing's so good, so these guys want to do it. They don't know what's going to happen with the movie.
Right.
But usually it comes down to, like, if it's a week, I'll do it, right?
Yeah, some people, you know, it's funny, because others would prefer more time.
Yeah.
You know, people like Melissa, she's like, I won't do 3 days, but I will do 7.
Right.
Even though it's the same amount of material.
Make sure she does a great job.
Yeah, and, you know, we just did a movie, and it was the same thing in Candyland, where the guy wanted extra time, same amount of money, you know, and I appreciate that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, you usually assume, you know, as little time as possible for most people, you know?
Yeah. Now, the Body Brokers, which is, you know, the movie that got us here, like, now, you went to rehab?
Oh, yeah.
How many?
I mean, tens.
Oh, really?
10 plus.
So you were one of those, it took a while.
It took a bit, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you know that life, you know that experience.
Very well, yeah.
And you just kept going back, though.
Yeah, well, you know.
Did you get court-ordered?
No.
No, you just couldn't fucking...
No, it's not even that I couldn't. It was more so like, you know, I lived, you know, somewhere between on the street and then kind of wherever I could find for so long that...
In Tulsa?
No, in, I mean, all over. Los Angeles, New Jersey.
Really? What was that part of the life?
Just...
You just went to these different... So you left Tulsa, and before you had started making movies, obviously.
Right.
And you went to New Jersey.
No, I went to... I guess I went to Colorado for a little while.
To do what?
Sell drugs.
Oh, okay.
You know, got involved in that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I came back to Oklahoma, and then...
When you were like 18?
I was
19?
18, 19, 20, and then I went to Chicago for a little bit. You know, I got a scholarship to an art school there. I applied, together a portfolio or whatever, and I spent, you know, I got about a cup of coffee there before I checked myself out. And,
but you had big plans, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it right this time.
Do it right. It's going to be great, you know, and tried to kick dope up there. Didn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know, got
on your own.
Yeah, on my own. Yeah. And then I went to Los Angeles and San Diego, and it just got worse and worse.
And then what's the New Jersey part?
So when I was making the first movie, and a short film before, A guy and I were working together, and he lived in New Jersey. So we would go and you know, spend some time up there.
So it got, it's worse in San Diego.
Yeah, yeah, it got really bad there. Yeah.
Yeah, like you weren't, you were incapacitated, not doing anything.
No, I mean, I was, you know, I was selling things to make my habit, you know, to keep, maintain a habit. Yeah. And, you know, it just got really dark, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're lucky to be alive, guy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's interesting that you were able to, like, that somehow or another your talent or your desire to create won out.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, you have, you're capable of it.
Sure.
I mean, like, that doesn't always happen, but I have to assume that has something to do with the fact that you are capable of it. Because a lot of people have dreams of doing things that get lost in drugs, but there's no indication that they could have done them anyways.
Right.
So when did you know that you could? When did you start doing creative work?
When I was like 14
yeah.
or 15, I started painting. That was my first thing I did.
Because your mom was a painter.
Yeah, yeah, and I got into it. And
did you have a feel for it?
Yeah, I was pretty good. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
I eventually did pretty well with it. But you know, I took a painting over to this woman's house. She owned a salon. She said, "How much?" And as a joke, I said $800.
Yeah.
And she went in the back and gave me a check. And I was like, I'm just never going to work again in my life, you know?
What a racket.
Yeah, so, you know, once I got a little taste for that, it was, you know, it kind of stuck with me. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've never not, I've wanted to do what I'm doing for as long as I can remember.
Where did you, get the chops? I mean, when did you go to school for filmmaking?
No. No, I mean, I've just, you know, I've made a lot of mistakes. And,
well, I mean, but how does it start?
You know, I started writing what I thought was a script, but was more like a, you know, some terrible novel.
Yeah.
And
when was this?
This was when I was in, 14, 15.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kicked it around, tried to figure out how to make a movie, finally decided, okay, well, this movie all takes place in one day. What happens the day before?
Yeah.
And so it was like we decided we'd make a short film about the day before.
Huh.
And so that's what we did. And, you know, that got me a taste of, okay, this is how you make something on a smaller scale.
But who'd you get in touch with? Were these just guys you were hanging out with?
Yeah, what'd
you shoot it on?
We shot it on an Alexa. You know, we got on a, you know, Craigslist and met some people.
Yeah.
And put some people together. I met my wife. She was an actress. She auditioned for this and was in the short film.
This is when you were in L.A.?
No, this was on New Jersey.
Oh, in Jersey.
Yeah. And we just put it together. And in 3 days, we shot a short. And I remember just the feeling I had of making something in the process of filmmaking was, it was addicting to me, you know, so.
And did you, enter it into things?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, you can, it actually ended up, it played like, in Cannes, short programming section, which, you know, didn't really do anything for me, but what we did was, is we rented out theaters around the country and we got in a car and we drove around and we would paper the town and just try and get people to come in and see our short film. And you know what,
how long was it?
It's 20, I think it was 23 minutes.
And that was the whole evening for those people?
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, some people showed up, some people didn't. Either way, we'd tell them what we were trying to do. And finally we went back to Tulsa and we had a screening and we packed the house and it played and people were really freaked out or disturbed. And then the
what
next,
was it about?
It was about an abusive father, who is kind of taking advantage of his daughter, and she has a brother, and he's trying to get her out and get her to run away with him.
So this is sort of like you broaden this theme and run with the
hunter. I worked this theme out. Yeah, I've worked it out, and so you know, the next morning I got a call at about 6 a.m. and it was this guy that I'd known, you know, from a kid I knew, his dad. And he said, "Where are you? And can you meet me for coffee?" Met him for coffee, and he said, "You know, I saw your film, and how much money do you want?" And I told him, "Like $200,000." And he was like, "Great,
to make your next movie."
Yeah, great. Let's make the feature movie you want to make.
Yeah.
And so you know, we started prepping it, and that's you know what we did. And
I can make you a martyr.
Let me make you
let
a martyr
now. Yeah. So what's that movie about, since we can't find it anymore?
That movie is about the brother of this girl. he comes back from being out of town. He's been gone.
Oh, I see. So this is what you mean by the day before.
Right. So it's 6 years later, and okay. he comes back to town.
So you had this other story planned.
Yeah, this feature I had written, you know, been writing for, you know, since I was 14 years old. Yeah.
Okay. So the short was sort of the pitch.
Yeah, it was the pitch. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some guy took it by coincidence?
No, I mean, he's not a film guy, you know.
But you invited him to the screening?
Yeah, we had done, I think, 10 screenings, 10 cities.
Uh-huh. Looking for money.
Looking for money.
Okay.
Looking to meet people.
So you were inviting, you know, specific people.
Yeah, I mean, at the end, it was just like anybody that'll come and watch the fucking thing, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And this guy showed up, and, you know, I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity. You know?
So what happens in that movie that we can't see?
Yeah, so he comes back to save his sister, to finally get her. He's ready. And it basically all takes place in one day of kind of him coming back to his old life and having to reckon with all of these different, you know, problems that he left and messes. And the dad and him end up having, you know, kind of squaring off a little bit, you know.
You would think, yeah.
Yeah. So the dad's involved in crime and stuff.
Is that Marilyn Manson?
Marilyn Manson is the hitman that the father hires to kill his son.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't talked about this movie in a long time, so I'm having you're helping me formulate my pitch. Yeah, yeah.
So who played the dad?
Mark Bone Jr.
Oh, so he plays a heavy in that one.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. He's great in that movie. He's
yeah, he's one of those guys that I've been seeing around for years. I can't even remember the first place I saw him. But he's around. Like, he's always sort of around. I feel like, you know, I don't think I've met him, but I think I've seen him somewhere. He seems like a guy who's...
Awesome guy, man.
Yeah. He seems like he's got a past. He's a real guy.
Yeah. He's one of those people you meet in this, and he's like, you could sit and just have dinner with him and have a great time and wouldn't feel any...
Yeah.
You know, he's a real guy. Yeah. Yeah. So.
So that was that movie.
Right.
And what happened to it? You didn't get a distributor? Or?
No, we did. We did. We did a distribution deal. It got out there. It actually, you know, because of Manson, a lot of people saw it. You know, a lot more people than I think we anticipated seeing it saw it.
And what was the feedback on that?
It was, it you know, amongst the horror and like kind of the cult folks, they loved the movie.
So you would classify it as a horror movie?
No, I wouldn't. I would classify it as like a pulpy drama.
Okay.
You know.
Now, do you like the horror movies?
You know, I do now.
You didn't grow up with it then?
No, I didn't. I've been, you know, kind of going back to when we did this horror movie recently.
With Melissa.
No, this one was not. Ida Red was with Melissa. That's an action.
That's not a horror movie.
Yeah.
Candyland's a horror
Candyland.
Movie.
Okay. And, you know, after Ida Red with Melissa, I started kind of binging on horror and got really fascinated with it. And, wanted to make a horror movie.
What is it about it, you think?
I think it's...
Because I can't lock in.
I find it... you know, when I grew up, I was like, it's campy, it's not scary, I don't...
To me, it's frustrating, especially if it's a thriller. It's like, get on with it.
Yeah.
Kill all of them. What are you going to do?
I agree. And as a screenwriter, what attracted me was how liberating it is. Because all of these things you kind of get penalized for when writing a drama or, you know, a movie like a true crime or whatever you'd classify Body Brokers as... You're actually kind of, you're rewarded for with horror, like the campiness, like things being weird or not tying up, or like there's kind of this freedom.
I get it.
You know?
Yeah, I get, like, because I don't have any muscle to appreciate it, because I know, like what's his name, Rob Zombie, you know, does these sort of kind of like way over the top,
right.
pulpy,
right.
gross out horror movies with some of the original kind of B movie weirdos.
Right.
And it's sort of like a, you know, a John Waters trip, but only with horror.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, there is a camp to horror and not, I mean, like a campiness. And I think I can appreciate it, but I'm not sure I enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, it took me making, you know, four movies before it to appreciate the simplicity of it.
So what do you want to do with it? What did you do with it that you hadn't done before in these other movies? Because like, it seems like, you get to a point, and we can talk about Body Brokers in a second, where, you know, these two movies that explore stories about drug abuse, incest, exploitation, you know, death by one's own compulsion, that I guess that horror after a certain point is sort of like, I want to make a funny movie.
pretty much. Absolutely. You know,
like I can cover all those themes, yeah, but we can have a little more fun.
Yeah, well, you know, so after we made the last one, Ida Red, my producer, Jeremy Rosen, and I kind of had a talk, and it was like, okay, what are we going to do now? Because I make all these movies with him, and we're partners in these things. And I said, I had this idea for a horror movie. It won't cost us a lot of money. And it would be much, it would be a big departure from whatever I've tried to do.
Yeah.
And so that was what was cool about it, is it was kind of like going back down to square one with the amount of money we had. And, you know, we got all our friends in it. And it's more of a slasher John Waters vibe than like a straight up, you know, just run-of-the-mill horror movie.
Right.
So it's about truck stop hookers and cults and, you know.
Yeah. You know, Tulsa.
Tulsa, exactly. So there was something really liberating about not having a lot of money and trying to tell you know.
Well, that was always the case with those movies, I think, generally speaking.
Right, yeah. Right?
That's what developed that genre of B-horror movie.
And honestly, that's what, you know, like you said, make a comedy. It is, this one's a comedy to me. I think people are going to find it extremely disturbing, my humor.
Yeah.
But it's... It's really, really, I'm proud of it.
I get it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I would have thought about it like that until I just had this conversation with you. Like, I always knew that there was a campiness to horror, but the ridiculousness of some horror.
Right.
You know, just the amount of blood.
Right.
You know, the amount.
Sure. Right. Right.
I think it serves the same purpose to a certain type of person as comedy.
Right.
Right?
Sure. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, with the Body Brokers, like once you realize that, and I think I talked to Melissa Leo about this, about like, well, it's about the scams that people who owned rehab centers, the business built around Obamacare money that was afforded any recovery program that would establish itself as a recovery program. Mm-hmm. And the guys that ran them were usually funneling money, you know, through junkies, through testing, through turning junkies back out to get, you know, them back in so they could get the money. It was there were several different layers of scam that, you know, basically took advantage of the hopeless drug addict.
Right.
Right. So I was just curious in the making of the movie, what was the decision making process? Was there a conversation around whether to have the narrator or not?
There never was.
It was always there.
It was always there, and that was the toughest part of the movie for me. Is again, you know, this is a huge sprawling thing.
How do you get all those scams into one movie about one guy?
Exactly, because you know you know, before I sat down to write it, I thought about it. Okay, without the narrator, what is this? I don't think it really dips its toe in even. You know, I mean, you could just
follow. Oh, I see. You needed the explanation.
Yeah, you need to kind of provide all of the color commentary and fill in, you know, the gaps of, like, how big this actually is.
So you've got this sort of, like, chipper Satan.
Right,
talking about the golden age of being able to game the system at the expense of junkies' lives.
Right, right.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
So that's a tone.
Yeah, it's a tone. And, you know, I didn't know how else to tell the story without, like, having, you know, being able to provide all the facts along the way.
Right, because you wanted to cover all of them.
Right, and I couldn't even cover all of them because you only have, you know, 2 hours or
so
whatever it is.
When did you get hip to that? Like, why did that become a thing for you? When you were in rehab, did you realize it? Did you hear about it? Did you know what was going on? Were you being used in that way?
All of the above.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, for me, it didn't take me long when I went to rehab to realize that it wasn't, they didn't have the best intentions for me, you know?
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of these places are have you know, private funding or, uh-huh. or run by hedge funds. And, and I feel like, you know, hedge funds and people's health and well-being are, you know, if they're not at odds initially, they eventually will be, you know? And, you know, the bigger these places grow and the more money that's at stake, the more corners you cut. And
cutting corners, but like the whole part about, like, you know, relapsing, you know, we're bringing relapsers in on purpose to run money through them.
Yeah.
I didn't know about that, but I got a buddy who I bounced it off of, and because he works in that business, and he was like, oh yeah, all of it. I think he knew the guy that you based it on, maybe.
Maybe. I mean, there's a few of them. He might know one of them.
Yeah, out here.
Yeah, there's, yeah. So, you know, I, the first time I really got hip to it, I was in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I was kicking dope, and I was really fucked up and in a bad place. And, you know, I Googled on my phone, like, drug treatment centers or whatever, and I didn't even click on anything, but somehow they just get your number.
Uh-huh.
And they start calling you.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I kicked for like 3 or 4 days. This guy called me and he said, hey, you know, would you like to come to treatment? You know? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I guess, sure.
And this is like the Michael K. Williams character.
Yeah, this is like the guy in the call center.
Oh, the call center guy.
And
right,
he calls me and he's like, you know, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready yet, whatever. He calls me back again the next day.
Yeah.
Keeps calling me.
Yeah.
And eventually he, I'm like, you know, fuck it. I don't have any money. I can't get any more dope.
Yeah.
I'm ready to go. And so the next time he calls, I'm like, hey, I'm ready. And he's like, all right, well, how long have you been clean or off drugs? And I said, about 5-6 days. And he's like, okay, well, you can't show up and piss dirty or piss clean. If you piss clean, we can't take you.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, well, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, it's not. Just go to the Western Union. I'm going to send you some money for the cab to the airport. How much is it? And I was like, it's like $60.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. He's like, go now, and I'm going to buy your plane ticket.
Yeah.
So I go to the Western Union. There's $1,000 in the Western Union.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
$1,000?
$1,000.
Yeah.
So I call him, and he's like, yeah, you know, just get to the airport and make sure when you show up, you know, test positive for.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay.
So he said, use the money to get high.
Absolutely.
And then get on the plane.
And then get on the plane. He didn't say that, but that's what, I mean, you know, that's what he was saying. So I called a cab. The cabbie took me all around town. I got everything, saw everybody.
Yeah.
And then he drove me to the airport, and I'm just slamming dope in the back of the cab the whole way. I get on the plane. I fly down to Florida. There's a guy waiting for me in a car.
Yeah.
I get in the car, and he's like, hey, so do you have anything on you? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, this isn't a trick question. I just need to know. And I was like, yeah, I do. And he's like, all right, we'll pull off. So we pull off at this little, you know, quick stop or whatever. And he's like, you want a 40? Like, and I was like, yeah, sure. So he grabbed me a beer and I just sat in the back of his car and, you know, was slamming dope and
drinking a beer.
And then he took me in and dropped me off. And so that was like a blatant example of how corrupt these places had gotten.
So for that $1,000 of investment, he was able to run taxpayer money through you into the system that he was working for.
Right.
In the number like $35,000-$40,000 more.
Yeah, probably more.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you knew, so how could you not know there's some sort of scam to it?
So then to make matters worse, I'm there. It's a terrible place. It's a really dirty, you know.
In Florida.
Yeah, it was a really rough place.
Yeah.
And I called a buddy out here in Los Angeles, and I said, you got to get me out of here. You got to get me out of here.
Yeah.
And he's like, and I knew he worked in treatment, and he was like, well, I can give you a guy's number who can.
Right.
So I talked to this guy, and he's like, yeah, we can get you out here. You know, once you complete the 30 days, we'll fly you out here, and you can stay in our place. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, do you have anybody out there that would want to come with you? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, I'll pay you $1,000 per person you bring from that treatment center to mine. So
this all, really?
Yeah. Really. So, you know, I got a hop in my step now because I'm like, you know, I go back into the cafeteria and I'm like, hey, man, you want to go to L.A.? You ever been to L.A.? You know, like, you're a funny guy. You could be a comedian. You want to go to L.A.? I'll introduce you to everybody. You know, and so I got about 6 people to go with me.
Really?
Yeah.
On the same plane?
No. So I flew ahead and then the next week, once they completed their time there, they went too. And I didn't know that this was wrong. You know, I just figured like, oh, you know, we're all going to Los Angeles
together. And you make $6,000.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the best of both worlds. So I did that. And once I got there, out here and they showed up and I kind of started to realize that this was like a real thing that was going on because, you know.
One of the scams.
Yeah. One of the scams.
Yeah.
And, you know, I ended up going back out with my $6,000 and getting high and, you know, taking myself on a little, you know, a tour. And then I got sober later. But, you know, after that, I'd been sober for about 3 years and I came out here to visit my wife when she was working. And I talked to one of my buddies who ran a treatment center and he was like, you got to sit down with me and hear how crazy this has gotten. And I was like, I have no interest in getting back into that. I'd really done a good job in running a clean program. I didn't want to be around anybody who was involved in it.
Yeah.
And I ended up going and meeting with him eventually, went to a meeting, and then afterwards we sat and talked, and he broke it down for me, and he called some people and had them come over and tell me what was going on. And I couldn't believe it, the amount of money and how this thing had kind of mushroomed into this real cottage industry.
What was the doctor scam again?
So the doctor scam is, you know, they will basically, you know, so if you're an opiate addict or alcohol, you can get a chip, like an implant put in you, which will block the receptors to your brain for, for you know, dopamine or whatever, or, you know, opiates. And, so what they would do is anybody, you know, they would take anybody.
Yeah.
They'd go on the street and just pick up people, you know, homeless people, and say, hey, we'll give you $300. You want to come in? You get this thing put in you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a week later, we'll take it out of you and we'll pay you, you know, give you $400 all in.
So they got the money for the surgery, which is at a cap.
Right.
And they would just use these people, pay them out, and still make
a
profit.
Right. Because they're making, you know, $20,000 a surgery.
Right, right.
So,
wow.
So that was the whole thing. And,
and these are all desperate, sick people.
Oh, yeah.
So they're easy marks.
Easy.
Because they don't give a shit.
Easy. I wish somebody had asked me back then to do it, you know?
Because
I would have done it. I would have been like, oh, you know.
And now, so that's what, so this is what your movie, that you're trying to encompass all of this through this kind of, you know, through the series of characters. Like the Michael K. Williams character in that movie, obviously not as, you know, demonic as the main guy.
Sure.
Played by that guy, what's his name, Grillo?
Frank Grillo.
Frank Grillo.
Yeah.
Like, he seems like a real guy. Like, he seems like one of the guys out here.
Frank's amazing. Yeah.
But like, he's the real Satan.
Yep.
Right? So, and Michael K. Williams is just a dude who's making a personal compromise, knows what's up, and he's working the system to make his own money. He's a contractor.
Right, right.
For the devil.
Right.
Yeah. And then, like, the poor kid, Val Kilmer's kid, is that who it is?
Yeah.
He's a good actor.
Yeah, he's great.
He gets sucked into it.
Yep.
But like, I thought that the way he played it, which was like almost void of any real character or personality in a way.
Right.
Just a like a naif kind of, right?
Yeah. And that was intentional on in casting.
Because
he's kind of,
Yeah, and the girl was a little monster.
Yeah.
But, you know, and how you characterize your own experience, and then the end of that movie, like it can't really end in any other way. But it's pretty raw, man. Right?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. Yeah.
What do you mean? How is that not going to be raw?
Well, you know,
with the guy splitting. That's the one thing that people don't realize is just like, you know, anytime, I don't want to ruin the ending, but you know, when that shit goes down, there's usually more than one person in the room or
sure.
in the car.
Absolutely.
There's always somebody.
There's always
split.
Somebody there. That's right.
Yeah.
That's like, right.
And take the dope.
No, I've been that guy, you know? Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. It's rough, man. You know?
That kind of decision, you know, like moving a body outside.
Just, you know, it's something that if you're going to choose to do that for the length
of time. If that's your life.
If that's your life and for a period of time it was mine, you're going to run into that kind of stuff.
People are going to go down.
Especially with fentanyl out there now.
Oh,
I mean, it's,
my God.
You were
at the beginning of it.
At the beginning. I remember the first time I saw somebody go on fentanyl, and it was one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen. Yeah.
What happened?
It, you know.
They don't know it.
Well, I've seen people, unfortunately, you know, move on when they're shooting regular dope.
Yeah.
But with fentanyl, it was like a demon was leaving this person's body. Like he turned into a contortionist and started twisting and writhing. And it was like he was trying to fight for whatever was left in him to stay.
Ugh.
And he clenched up and then he just went limp and fell out of a chair.
Did he know that was what it was?
Neither of us knew.
So that was just in there.
It was just in there. And,
oh, my God.
You know, and it's...
And that's where you had maybe thought for a second, yeah, maybe I'm not going to take the hit.
No, I mean, honestly, you know, the sickest part about it is it must be some really good dope.
Right. Well, that's always the case.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he did too much or he didn't do it right.
Right, yeah.
If I just half it up.
I mean, that's, you know...
Well, yeah, that was always the thing in New York. I remember realizing that.
Yeah.
That any time there was like... when it was all the China White in the late 80s, that when it was around, if people started dropping dead, all the other junkies are like, where are they getting it?
Well, that's true. I mean, and there was a joke in New Jersey when I was there where, you know, junkies would watch the evening news.
To see
because it would say, you know, today in whatever county
four
or town.
Overdoses.
Yeah, four overdoses. And then the next morning, everybody would be there for the morning shift, you know, to pick up.
That is crazy.
Yeah. So it's free advertising. You know?
So you saw, like, you know, you really saw, you were really in the shit and saw that stuff and kind of, it must have, like, whatever you had to process once you, like, got hold of sobriety must have been heavy.
Yeah, I think so. But
were they close friends, any of them, or just people that you knew in the life?
I've known a few close friends, but the people I saw were not. You know, they were just, you know, running buddies that
Yeah. People you saw at the place where you
That guy, you know, he and I ran around for like 3 weeks together.
Right.
And then that happened. You know,
wow, man. So did you ever meet Larry Clark?
No, I never did. He's still alive, you know, but
it seems like you got to meet him. I talked to him.
I listened to that. Yeah. Yeah.
It was hard to wrangle that one, but I think I did.
I was there with you. You know? I was very excited for that one. It was a tough one to keep in bounds, but I'm a huge fan, man. Yeah, I'd love to.
It's so interesting, like guys like that who have there's so much hustle to them.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, you got, you know, the real story, then you got the hustle, and then you got the hustle that they're pulling on you.
Right, right.
You know, like.
Well, he's a pro, man. I mean, that's like, you know, he's the real deal. You know, this life that we're talking about, and, you know, and he's been around a long time. I was actually the other day looking, there was a few photos of from Tulsa for sale, and I was, you know.
I mean, he must have done editions of that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I've got a reprint of the book.
Yeah, I just bought a first edition.
You did?
Yeah, but, you know, I wanted to buy, my buddy has one of the original prints, and I want one.
How much did they go for?
Like 20?
20, yeah.
Which seems reasonable to me.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I was really thinking about it. I don't know, I got to get a, you know, a good paying gig, and I'll buy it for myself. But
Man. Yeah. You gotta go meet Larry, too.
Yeah, I don't know where he's, I think he's in like Europe or something.
Is
I don't know.
He?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Yeah. Those guys, like, you know, they're always taken care of by a strange contingent of money. You know, and weirdness. You know, they're like always like, you know, I don't know how they get around the world. It's like Bukowski, you know, it's almost always carrying Bukowski.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah.
In Europe, he'd go to Europe and they'd be celebrated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Here, I don't know.
Same with like Abel Ferrara. You know?
Same thing. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He's over in Rome right now. They have these patrons, it seems like.
Yeah, you know. Someone takes it. I wonder if they're institutions or they're individuals or how it works, you know?
Man, I wish I knew. Yeah.
Well, me might be one of those guys. You might keep at it. You'll find out. Just like you found out about the drug scams. Right. You'll find out about how one lives in Europe for a year on someone else's dime making a slasher movie. That's what you're working towards. A big payoff, man.
Things to work towards, yeah.
So what happens now with, you know, because, you know, I certainly put that movie out there a bit. And, hey, but you have any sense of... where it went. So it's on HBO now, though, right? It's going to be in
HBO
rotation.
Max. Yeah, it'll be, you know, I don't really know what they're going to do with it, but I know that's where it's going.
How did that deal work? Like, when did that happen?
It happened...
What's the process as a filmmaker? So you make the movie. Who gave you the money for that movie?
That was a kind of a hodgepodge of private equity. A few companies chipped in. It was a really hard movie to get the money for. Yeah.
Now, when you say you have experience with people having problems with endings, is that one of those things where, you know, when you're looking for money... And do you show people that script?
Yeah, I did. I did. And nobody had a problem with that because anybody I pitched on the script, I could tell this is my story.
Right.
And they couldn't believe the whole thing, you know?
Right.
Then you get to the end and it's like, well, I guess that's how it's supposed to end. But really the people that had problems with it, which was ironic, were the film festivals. You know, because we were actually going to do festivals, you know, before the pandemic hit. But the festivals that we, you know, were talking to were like, yeah, but it's just so dark at the end. And it's like,
what kind of festival are you running?
Yeah,
is this a film festival?
Right, you know, and so it was ironic because, you know, most of those people have never made a movie themselves and, you know.
But it's so weird because that, to me, says that, you know, some of these festivals, I don't know which ones you're talking to, are so dug in terms of who they attract.
Absolutely.
That they're playing to a certain audience.
Right.
You know, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's a sort of a middle class artsy fartsy audience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That doesn't they're just trying to keep their support as opposed to
most of them, or at least the American ones have such, you know, heavy corporate influence that you know, kind of shrouded in independence, you know.
Yeah. One of our big donors is a drug rehab here in town, so we can't really and we're a little concerned about your film because we're getting a lot of money from Hazleton. You know. Now I'm not down. I'm not saying anything bad about Hazleton. It was the only one that came to my head. Been around a long time. I'm sure they're on the level.
Yeah. From everything I've heard, they are. Yeah.
They are. Yeah. They're the old timey ones.
Right.
Okay. So you make the movie. You pick up a distributor for a bit.
Right.
And then how does HBO get involved?
So typically with a movie like this size, a lot of distributors will want to have a TV partner. So what that means is, you know, the distributor will put it out for 3 to 6 months.
Right.
You know, on, you know, Amazon, Apple TV, all that for rent or buy.
Right.
And then 6 months later, they'll, you know, partner with a TV person like HBO Max or a streamer to then, you know, lease it for a period of like 18 months or so.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
So this is your time.
I guess.
On HBO Max.
Yeah, yeah. This will be my time. Yeah.
Now, has you found that, like, we're after that one, how... Well, I guess it wasn't really out when he started doing Ida Red. How'd you finance that? Same way?
No, Ida Red, we had two, you know, reputable, well-known companies kind of come in and you know, wrap their arms
because
around.
Of your work.
I guess. Also the cast, you know, they really like the cast.
Sure.
And the story. I mean, it's kind of a, like I said, it's kind of a throwback homage to, you know, Peckinpah kind of stuff. And that stuff usually does well.
People like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And what about... Candyland.
Candyland was all was financed by two people, and Jeremy is one of the main people who put up the money for that because he believes in it so much.
That's
so,
your manager?
Yeah, manager and producer. Yeah,
the guy who's in my house right now.
Yeah, the guy who's in the house. Yeah, he's a fucking a killer, man. Great dude.
Well, I wish you best of luck with everything. It's great talking to you.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
I think we covered it.
Hopefully, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, we got a guy dying on fentanyl. I mean, that's, you know. we dug in, and that's what we found.
Well, dude, thank you so much. And you played a big part in my recovery.
Oh.
You know, yeah. I mean, early on, you know, attraction, not promotion. But
sure.
I would listen to your show, and I remember laying in... a detox bed listening to one of the shows, and you mentioned to the guy, you're a sober guy, right?
Yeah.
Me too. And you guys went on this whole thing, and it actually really, it helped, you know, because, you know, it may be stupid or whatever, but people, you know, like yourself out here doing, you know, what I wanted to do,
right.
You know, doing, trying, you know, doing this thing, being sober, it provided, you know, some...
you knew it was possible.
Yeah. Yeah, and it really, you know, it helped me. So being here means a lot, and I appreciate you helping out our film. We need it. And,
yeah. Well, it means a lot to me too, man, because, like, you know, kicking the life that you kicked is it's a really hard one, and you seem good, and, you know, just, you know, stay on it. And
do what I can, yeah.
Yeah, you look great, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you.
Man, heavy tales. That dope is no good, man. Hard to come back from the dope, but it's doable. John's movie, Body Brokers, is now available to buy or rent on digital and on-demand platforms, or you can watch it on Cinemax starting tomorrow, July 9th. The new film, Ida Red, begins playing on the festival circuit in August. Now let's play some music and get on with it. Get on with it. Get on with it. Monkey and LaFonda and Cat Angels. Cat Angels, man. Cat Angels everywhere. Oh, they're coming down fast.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.